It's here and now. Coming up, our conversation about New Orleans. Time magazine says the situation in the city is pathetic and a setup for another catastrophe. But first, Robert E. Murray, chair of Murray Energy Corporation, a part owner of Utah's Crandall Canyon mine, where six miners are trapped, says the collapse of the mine was a natural disaster, an earthquake, not man-made, and he will prove it. Rescue teams are working around the clock to try to get to the miners, and the force of the collapse Monday night was so strong that seismologists at first thought it was an earthquake. Ben Winslow has been covering the story for Deseret News in Utah. Ben, first of all, have scientists definitively ruled out an earthquake?
They're taking another look at it, certainly, but the University of Utah seismograph stations, which measures earthquake activity in Utah, it appears to be of the belief that the seismic event that happened that measured 3.9 on the Richter scale was the mine collapsing.
Given the size of the event, do officials think that the men are alive?
If they got into an area where they think they are, and if they weren't injured or killed in the initial collapse, the mine's owners and operators certainly believe that there's a good chance that they are alive. They're in an area, they believe, where there is plenty of oxygen and water. They also have breathing apparatus with them. Right now, it's a matter of trying to get in contact with them. They've gotten within 1,700 feet of them. They've tried a number of different ways. They're trying four separate ways to reach these miners. One method did not work out as well as they had hoped. They had got into an area where they thought they may be able to drill a few hundred feet to reach them, and they found that that mine shaft that they were trying had debris in it.
The mine was reported to be working on something called retreat mining, which experts say is the most dangerous mining technique. First of all, can you tell us briefly what that is, and what do officials at the mine say about whether or not they were doing it?
Well, there's some dispute over what exactly they were doing, what type of mining they're doing, and I'll admit I'm no mining expert. The miners that I have talked to have said that that mine, Crandall Canyon, has been mined out before. It's basically they're going in and getting what's left of the coal that's in there as they move their way from back to front. They move their way from inside the mine toward the entrance.
They're retreating as they mine.
Mine.
But do officials say that that's what was happening?
Officials are kind of choosing words. At least last we understood that that they were, you know, not necessarily calling it retreat mining, but using other terms.
We also see reports that this mine had been sighted 325 times by government mine inspectors. It's sounding oddly like last week's Minneapolis bridge collapse, in that people are saying that these sightings were significant and substantial, meaning that they could cause injury. But then we're also hearing from former mine officials that while that's not perfect, it's not bad. So what is the assessment of the safety of this mine?
It's no different than a lot of other mines, at least according to local miners that I've talked to in that area. They have quite the lengthy list of citations, but you also have to remember this is a very heavily regulated industry, mining is. Since 2005, the Mine Safety Health Administration has cited Crandall Canyon 176 times for a number of violations. Many of them were deemed significant. There were issues with escapeways. There were issues with other safety measures taken in the mines. But when you ask people who provide an overall perspective, a lot of mining experts, they say that, you know, the mine isn't perfect, but it's not bad either.
And mining is a dangerous business. And
it is a very dangerous business. You're working in some interesting conditions. It can be dank and wet, or it can be dry. It's dark. You go down there for shifts of 10 to 12 hours at a time. And it can be very, very dangerous work.
We understand of the six miners, four are Hispanic. There's been some difficulty communicating, you know, with their families. But we also understand that dozens of rescuers are lining up. How's the community reacting?
You know, these are tight-knit communities. This is coal country. This is not uncommon in these areas, and people are very, very close together.
You know, I mentioned Minneapolis and the bridge. We're about to speak about failed levees and New Orleans. Do people there think of this as a, you know, broader story of infrastructure, or is this to them a mining story?
The sense that I get is that this is a mining story, and when you talk to people who go into these mines every single day and this is their job, it is in the back of their mind, the possibility of a collapse. I talked to one miner who said that every day when he goes in there, it's in the back of his mind that this could happen to him. But it's kind of one of those things you have to swallow, and you just go in and you do your job.
Ben Winslow, reporter for the Deseret News in Utah. Ben, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
In New Orleans, they have two new sayings. One is, make levees, not war. Another is, fix the coast or we are toast. Nearly 2 years have gone by since Hurricane Katrina drowned New Orleans in late August, and while parts of the city have rebounded, for instance, you can fly into the airport or stay in a nice hotel in the historic French Quarter, neighborhoods such as the poor, largely African-American Lower Ninth Ward remain largely uninhabited, acre after acre of nothing but concrete slabs where homes once stood. In its fifth cover story about Hurricane Katrina, Time magazine reminds us Katrina wasn't even the big one, and it wasn't what cut the city down. Years of misguided policies and bureaucratic bungling did that, and it could happen again. Joining us from the studios of WLRN in Miami is Time magazine senior correspondent Michael Grunwald, who wrote the cover story. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
In a foreword to the article, the managing editor of Time calls what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina a 21st century morality tale. And he describes you as obsessed with this story. What obsesses you about it?
Well, I've been kind of obsessed with the Army Corps of Engineers for about 8 years now, ever since I started reporting about them for the Washington Post. I started out writing about how they were building all these kind of preposterous boondoggles that were environmentally destructive as well as fiscally wasteful, but nobody paid a lot of attention. Of course, after Hurricane Katrina, people started to pay a little bit more attention. This was kind of exactly what I'd been banging my spoon on my high chair about for all that time, and since then it's been tough for me to think about other things.
Well, you mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers, and it seems as if you and others, and by the way, Time has a huge project here where people can weigh in online with their thoughts about New Orleans, and they are, and we'll get to some of them, but the point everyone seems to be making is the problem is that over the years, the Army Corps of Engineers practiced containment of the river rather than letting it do its thing and overflow. Now, that's counterintuitive for many of us, so explain that.
Well, sure. I think you got at it a little bit when you said you mentioned fix the coast or we are toast. You know, the Army Corps, for very understandable reasons, has been waging a kind of 100 years war against the Mississippi River. You need to have some flood control there. It's, you know, it's a beast, and if you didn't fight it, you couldn't have a city like St. Louis or you know, or Cairo, Illinois, or New Orleans. But that said, as the Army Corps has sort of caged the beast into its channel with these massive levees as well as armoring the banks, and you've sort of stopped the river from doing its natural land-building thing.
Tell us more about that, because when rivers overflow their banks, they do what? They deposit sediment.
Well, exactly. New Orleans was actually originally built on a natural levee where the Mississippi had deposited some of its silt along its banks. Now, as you cut off that river, it can't pick up its silt and the banks don't erode anymore. Pretty soon, the wetlands that used to provide natural storm protection for the city has been sinking into the Gulf at an astonishing rate.
Is it possible? You have a fact here, and I thought this can't be, that these wetlands, marshes, cypress swamps, the barrier islands, are disappearing at a rate of a football field nearly every half an hour?
That's right. It comes out to nearly 25 square miles a year.
Well, and we should say that when you say that the levees keep the water from overflowing and depositing the sediment that builds up the land, the levees upriver also keep the intent there is to keep the banks of the river from falling in. And if you do that, that might be good for the city or town upriver. Are you saying, Michael Grunwald, that levees are entirely wrong? I mean, we think of levees, you know, you need a levee, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's been lost in southern Louisiana is really the kind of notion, sort of common sense notion, that where you have people, you need to protect them, and where you don't have people, that's where you kind of want to let Mother Nature do its thing. When the Army Corps originally started building its hurricane protections around New Orleans, it did not build its levees around the people. Three-quarters of the levees were actually built around swampland. And the stated reason at the time was to promote development of these kind of low-lying wetlands in places that became New Orleans East. It seemed really fantastic at the time. God, we've created land, and it's 15 feet below sea level. Of course, it didn't seem like such a great idea after Hurricane Katrina came, and suddenly that area was underwater again. What the scientists say is you need a certain amount of levees in those areas. New Orleans does not have nearly the protection it needs. They're saying it's going to take until 2011 just to provide protection from a 100-year storm, not even what they're saying would protect against Katrina.
You quote Tulane Law Professor Oliver Houck, who you say is the sage of Louisiana environmentalism, as saying Katrina was just a perfect excuse to pull the old pork off the shelf in the name of otherwise we'll drown in a way. Here we go, another Louisiana hayride. Are you saying that that's still happening, that despite whatever lessons should have been learned from Katrina, that the pork jobs are what's getting done?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I mean, one of the ways that New Orleans ended up underwater is that the Army Corps of Engineers spent more money in Louisiana than any other state before Katrina. The problem was that they were spending a lot of it on pork barrel projects that not only weren't they protecting New Orleans, they were making it more exposed to the Gulf. Things like the New Orleans Industrial Canal is a classic example of a project, $750 million boondoggle that was supposed to help the port of New Orleans. And just a few feet away are some of those flood walls that failed during Hurricane Katrina, and they could have used a little bit of that money. So you'd think that after Hurricane Katrina, it would be the state of emergency. Well, we're not going to do that anymore. And exactly the opposite. The first big hurricane project out of the chute that the House just passed it last week is this Morganza to the Gulf project, a $900 million hurricane levy for these isolated bayou towns like Dulac and Covin and Montagu, places that you've never heard of with very few people. And even the people who are the top supporters of these levies acknowledge that it's going to destroy more wetlands and increase the coastal land losses that have exposed that coast to the kind of disasters we saw 2 years ago.
But what do you suggest be done? One engineer you spoke with said, but if we don't protect the Dulac, you mentioned Dulac, there won't be a Dulac. You're saying maybe there shouldn't be a Dulac?
Well, there are going to have to be some hard choices. One of the things people in Dulac told me is like, you know, hey, if we have to go, we understand that. They just want somebody to tell them, you know. You're going to have to say, all right, well, we're going to be able to build here and we can't build here. We're going to have to retreat here and here we're going to take our stand.
But
those kind of decisions have not been made yet. Right now, there's still this notion that, oh, well, we're going to try to provide everybody this sort of minimal protection, which ends up providing protection for no one.
That's Michael Grunwald, senior correspondent for Time Magazine and author of the book The Swamp. It's about the Everglades. And he says FEMA, the federal agency, and its head, Michael Brown, or Brownie, as President Bush called him, were blamed for failures in the recovery effort after Katrina. But actually, it was the Army Corps of Engineers whose misplaced policies, you know, removed the wetlands and created the problem in the first place. He's going to be back with more. And this note later in the program, the power of branding. In a taste test, kids preferred food inside McDonald's wrapping, even if it was the same food that was in other wrappers. McDonald's wrapping made it taste better for them. We'll have more. Everything after a break here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now, back with more from Time Magazine senior correspondent Michael Grunwald. His cover story this week blames Hurricane Katrina on the Army Corps of Engineers for two reasons. For years, the Corps contained the flood-prone Mississippi River with levees that protected towns upstream of New Orleans by holding up embankments. But that means that less silt spilled into the river. Then, as the river came downstream, the Corps built levees in too many places to keep the river from flowing out and depositing whatever silt it had to build up land, wetlands, which keep New Orleans from washing away. Then the cycle continues. As the city sinks for lack of silt, more levees are built to prevent it from sinking. At the same time, these levees are being built in remote fishing towns such as Dulac. Michael, you know there are those who say that the idea of moving people out of neighborhoods, such as the devastated Lower Ninth Ward, in order to restore barrier wetlands, is a plot to move African Americans, who are more likely to be Democratic voters, to make Louisiana a red state. Touch on that.
Well, at this point, there's no reason to move people out of New Orleans. You know, what you have to do is protect New Orleans.
Well, what do you
there's
do about
already
the,
a footprint.
What,
there are levees around it. You got to build them higher and make sure that what happened to the lower Ninth Ward never happens again. It's outside. It's whether you're going to extend the footprint of those levees all the way across the state. Those are where the tougher decisions are going to have to be made. In Amsterdam, there's 10,000-year flood protection. And in New Orleans, I think, you know, people would say, you know, it's going to take $15 billion just to get them to 100-year flood protection. I think most people would say that New Orleans deserves a lot better than that.
Well,
but if that's where you're going to put your resources, then you can't do that and, you know, and spend billions of dollars, you know, providing 100-year protection to places like Duloc that are just going to increase the danger to places like New Orleans. And that's where it becomes a question of priorities.
You mentioned Amsterdam. Harry Shearer, the comedian, the writer, he's known for the voices of The Simpsons. He writes in a piece that's in the Times online version of this coverage, let's just call in the Dutch.
Well, I'm not an engineer. I think there's no doubt that that as far as engineering goes, they could not have done any worse. You know, they miscalculated the type of storm they were trying to defend against. They built their levees in soggy soils. They built the wrong kind of design for their levees. It was just one error after another, and it's, you know, it's really inexcusable. Some of them were not entirely the Army Corps' fault, but ultimately it was the Corps' responsibility. There's a lot of division about whether the Corps is capable of doing it in the future. You know, they've already started working towards 100-year storm protection. They've had a lot of trouble with some of their pumps and floodgates around some of the failures last time. There have been some questions about the flood walls that they're rebuilding. But I think at this point, they're the only game in town. And where public policy is really going to play a role is where we tell them where to build their levees and where we tell them what to do with the coast. Because the scientists believe that they can fix the coast. It's not going to be easy. It's going to require saying no to some people. It's going to require navigation to make some changes. You might have to fill in some oil and gas canals. You may have to move some people places where they don't want to move. The Army Corps so far has said, well, we're going to try to do everything we can without causing economic harm and without causing inconvenience. You know, 2 years ago, you know, a pretty modest hurricane came and the Army Corps' protections failed, and it ended up causing a pretty fair amount of economic harm and inconvenience. You'd think that at this point, job one, priority one would be never again. Let's make sure this never happens again, and if we have to break a few eggs to make this omelet, so be it. But so far, that has definitely not been the attitude. It's let's try and find a consensus. Let's work with all the stakeholders and come up with a plan that everybody can support. And right now, the first things that have come off the shelf are those old levee plans from before Katrina that were formed in a very different era that suddenly everybody says, great, more storm protection. We'll take it here in Duloc.
When you say we have to tell the Army Corps of Engineers how to do this, who's this we?
Well, I guess I'm talking about America. The problem with water resources policy in this country is that there is no policy. The Army Corps is the only agency that's really funded almost exclusively by earmarks, individual projects sort of inserted into bills by individual members of Congress. So you don't have an agenda. There are no setting of national priorities. There's just this annual scramble for funding among the agency's 535 bosses. You know, if we want to change that, it's going to require telling Congress that, you know, we need to do this differently. But, you know, pork is bipartisan. And there is unbelievable support for the Army Corps and both sides of the aisle, from right-wingers, left-wingers, buffalo-wingers, you name it. Everybody wants to support the Corps. And so it's going to be very difficult to slow up that freight train.
Michael Grunwald, your magazine, Time Magazine's website, has some astonishing pictures. There's photographs of sarcophagi, concrete coffins that had been unearthed by the storm. They're still not buried in one New Orleans cemetery. You know, picture of a high school class with just a few kids. Just what image, you know, sticks with you?
Well, I guess it would be going to the Lower Ninth Ward. I took a tour with a woman named Pam Daschle. And this is a woman who's been sort of fighting against pork barrel projects for the Port of New Orleans right next to the flood walls that failed. So I went to the Lower Ninth with her a few weeks ago, and we got to see these areas that, you know, I was there after Katrina, and you saw the buses and the trees and the houses that had been blown all over the place and the endless debris. And now what you see is just about nothing. You'll see these, you know, a slab here, a gas meter there, these kind of silent reminders that there were lives there that were washed away and how a vibrant neighborhood that no longer exists. You don't see people rebuilding. You don't see signs of life. It's becoming a nature preserve. So that's what's really going to stick with me. What Pam told me is that that she stands here and she thinks about the short-sighted people who crippled an American city. And what I've said is that if we don't get some better levees from New Orleans and some restored wetlands for the entire coast, they're not going to cripple the city. They're going to kill it.
Michael Grunwald has long been writing about what he calls coastal mismanagement. In fact, his book is called The Swamp, about the Everglades, and he writes the cover story for Time magazine on Katrina. And we'll get you to the website by going to oursherenow.org. Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Okay, we're going to switch gears after the news. When Presidents Take Vacation, that's Here and Now. It's Here and Now. First, France's new president, Nicolas Sarkozy, horrified the French with his jogging in public. So American. And now he's on vacation in Sacrebleu, New Hampshire. Sarkozy and his family are staying in a $30,000 a week rental at Lake Winnipesaukee, guests of a friend. Vacations for American presidents can be all about sending out an image, and we're going to hear about that in a moment. But Sarkozy insisted he just wanted to be left alone. This past weekend, he and his family held a dockside press conference and photo opportunity for the press. And shortly after, the family set off on a boat, the president shirtless and in bathing trunks. Several yards away in another boat was photographer Vince DeWitt on assignment with one other cameraman and with permission of state police. But that didn't stop what happened next. Vince, what happened?
We saw the president gestured towards, there were actually two security boats here. And then I saw him pointing at us through my camera lens, and I thought it was, you know, one of those, hey, how you doing gestures. But then he started appearing pretty agitated.
So he comes towards you, and then what?
Well, we put our cameras down. You know, didn't want to cause any more. We were sort of in damage control now, and we're just waiting to see what was going to happen next. And they came right up next to our boat, and he grabbed the boats, pulled them together, and then he stepped into our boat, speaking still in French and very agitated.
Do you speak French? Did you know what he was saying?
No, I do not speak French. We asked for a translation. And,
but did you really need one? I mean, what was your sense of what he was saying? He wasn't saying, I love your lake. I mean, what was he?
Well, you know, we knew that he didn't want us to take photographs.
I can't imagine. This is the president of a country, a world leader, climbing right into your little boat. I'm trying to picture if, for instance, President Bush decided to go up and climb into somebody's boat. I can't imagine that. What were your thoughts?
I think I was going into a mild state of shock. It was just an amazing experience. His wife, very calmly and with a smile on her face, said, well, the president held a press conference this morning, and he asked that no pictures be taken. Well, it was in French, so of course we didn't understand what he was saying.
Anyway, right. I mean, can you see his point? This is a world leader trying to get a break. Can you have some sympathy?
Absolutely. I can see his point of view. And I told him that the last thing I wanted to do was disrupt his family vacation.
Well, some would say that actually it might be revealing that this is, I mean, perhaps the first international incident for this new French president. And he, you know, kind of got pretty combative.
Well, he did. I have mixed feelings about it because I would think as a head of state, he would realize he's, you know, in the public eye. I mean, I would just, my humble opinion opinion, say that he has a lot more important issues to deal with. But in the final analysis, from my point of view, I wish him well, and I wish his family well, and I hope that they, too, have a nice vacation.
Vince DeWitt, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, we love our Lake Winnipesaukee here in New England where we are, but many are asking, why is the French president here? Sarkozy says there's no political significance in his American retreat. In fact, he has no plans to meet President Bush, who's going to be vacationing at his parents' place just 50 miles away in Maine. Ken Walsh is White House correspondent for U.S. News & World Report and author of From Mount Vernon to Crawford, A History of Presidents and Their Retreats. Ken, put this in context. We can't imagine President Bush vacationing in the south of France. Is it unusual for world leaders to take vacation outside their home countries?
No. American presidents try to stay in the United States almost exclusively. But European leaders in particular and leaders of other countries do go elsewhere. Sarkozy mentioned in this dust-up he's had that just because he goes to the United States doesn't mean he thinks any less of other places he might vacation, such as Greece or his home of France. But I think this whole problem he's had this week with the photographers suggests why leaders like to go to their own retreats when they go on vacation, including American presidents, because they can control sort of the habitat, and they can avoid this sort of thing because their own homes and retreats are totally under their control.
Right. He is on Lake Winnipesaukee, which is hugely popular in this area.
Yes, it's not too far from Kennebunkport, Maine, which is where, it turns out, President Bush will be this weekend. So you sort of connect the dots there.
Right, and everybody is connecting the dots, and he's saying, wait, there are no dots, not realizing perhaps that that's what people do. They connect dots when vacations are taken. I mean, they may be, you know, looking in some cases just to get away and not, you know, not say anything by where they're going. But do presidents also look to make statements by where they go?
They do. Well, if you look at President Clinton, he did not have a home of his own. He was not a wealthy man when he took office, so he did not have an estate. So President Clinton actually took polls to determine where he should go on vacation before his reelection, and it turned out that most Americans wanted him to go to a national park, so sure enough, that's where he went. Of course, after he was reelected, he didn't go back again because he didn't particularly like it that much. He's not sort of an outdoor kind of guy. And he kept coming back to Martha's Vineyard, which is where he really liked to go.
We understand this was in 95 and 96, and it was orchestrated by Dick Morris, who was
exactly
his advisor at the time, and, you know, in reaction to polls. But then when the Clintons took up a friend's offer to, you know, stay in homes on Martha's Vineyard, they were taken to task by a lot of people.
They were, yeah. Well, you know, this is a man who portrayed himself as sort of connected to everyday America, but he was then mingling with the rich and famous. But he enjoyed it. It was the perfect kind of social environment Bill Clinton loved, where he could go to rounds of parties and be the center of attention every night, go out on people's yachts and so on. So Bill Clinton really didn't mind the attention.
Well, the other images, you know, on the other side of the aisle that come out are ranchers. You've got Presidents Bush and Reagan.
Yes, exactly. Well, we've had three presidents who went to ranches, Lyndon Johnson down in Texas, and President Reagan, who had a ranch, of course, in Santa Barbara. And the main feature of the ranch is the president can get seclusion. And now Lyndon Johnson used his ranch differently to convey the image of his president who was constantly in movement and engaged, having people flying in for these big meetings and so on. But for Presidents Reagan and Bush, the ranches are basically places to get away. And by the way, President Bush, the current president, never quite liked his father's estate in Kennebunkport because it was so open. People could be standing on the banks of the water and look at with binoculars at the president and his family coming in and out of the house. President Bush, the son, never liked that. So when he goes to his ranch, actually next week, he can be just left to his own devices there, and that's what he likes.
Ken Walsh, White House correspondent for U.S. News & World Report, also author of From Mount Vernon to Crawford, A History of Presidents and Their Retreats. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and if you're on vacation, remember you can listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, you can click on the archives, and you can download a podcast, Take Us With You When You Go, please. That's here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a transplant surgeon accused of hastening the death of a person in order to harvest organs. We'll look at some of the difficult questions around organ donations. That's tomorrow. And before we go today, the medical mystery mastermind, Robin Cook. You're listening to Here and Now. A new Stanford University study says that McDonald's ads have changed kids' taste buds.
McDonald's celebrates twisted fairy tale fun with the release of DreamWorks Shrek the Third, rated PG. There's one talking toy in every McDonald's Happy Meal.
That recent McDonald's TV ad offering kids toys in their Happy Meals may be one of the reasons that kids think food tastes better if they think it comes from McDonald's. The study authors offered preschoolers food wrapped in McDonald's packaging and the same food in unbranded wrappers, and kids said the McDonald's packaged food tasted better, even milk and carrots. Dr. Susan Lin is with the Judge Baker Children's Center and an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's also co-founder of Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. Susan, what do you think's going on here?
Well, I think that this is a very important study. And essentially, it's an important addition to the mounting evidence that marketing to children really does have a profound effect on them. And it even, to the point of influencing how things taste.
They tasted hamburgers, chicken nuggets, fries, milk, juice, carrots. And even when the carrots, as we said, were wrapped in McDonald's wrappers, they always said, same food, different wrapper, they always said the McDonald's tasted better.
Right. I think there are two important points here. One is that this shows that children's vulnerability to marketing and the fact that vulnerability to marketing really begins quite early. I mean, these were preschool children. And the other is that branding trumps actual sensory input. It really shows the power of branding to these, big food corporations.
It's amazing, but is it also perhaps potentially the good news? McDonald's has already said that it's only going to promote Happy Meals that offer fruit and have fewer calories and less fat. I mean, it seems as if researchers have found that they can get McDonald's to serve healthy food. All they have to do is put the wrapper on and kids will eat it.
Yeah, I think we need to be really cautious about what McDonald's says. I mean, I don't think that we should be depending on the food industry to be the guardians of public health. I mean, and that we have to remember that corporations are bound by law to promote profits, not children's well-being. A lot of McDonald's commercials don't have any food in them at all. I mean, what they're doing is promoting the brand. I mean, the commercials, showing that, Ronald McDonald's makes everybody happier and McDonald's is this magical, wonderful, fun place. And so, the individual commercials are less important. That's one thing. And the other thing is that McDonald's just came off of this Shrek campaign with the movie Shrek the Third, and they were talking about how they were going to be promoting a healthy Happy Meal with Shrek. But really, the ads were for any kind of Happy Meal. And once kids get in there, the toys that come in the Happy Meals, which are promoting, films or television programs, they won't just come with a healthy Happy Meal. They'll come with all of them.
Well, but, how much of a role should parents be playing here? Given what this research shows, isn't it the parents' responsibility to turn off the TV?
I think that, of course, parents have responsibility. But I think that it's, naive to think that one family in isolation can combat with the food industry. It's a $10 to $12 billion industry. And it's also important to remember that food marketing takes place in the context of marketing so many other things as well. The children are just bombarded. And I think we have to ask ourselves why we think it's okay for corporations to make parents' lives so much more difficult.
But to play devil's advocate here, a critic of the study has said, they only used McDonald's. What if one of the wrappers was, baseballs or flowers, beautiful flowers, or fish, things that kids love? Maybe they would have still said that the food tasted better, but it would have had nothing to do with marketing.
But that does have to do with marketing, because what it's about is what's on the package. And that's what marketing is about. It's to get kids to associate and have strong feelings about a particular logo or a particular character. that is selling the food.
We live in a free market society. Does your group, what, want to stop advertising to children, make it more truthful?
There can be limits, and there are limits to what a free market means. We have limits on cigarette marketing, and what we really need is to set limits on advertising and marketing to children. And I think that this study is such a really good example of why that's so important. Kids are so vulnerable to it that it even trumps actual sensory input.
Dr. Susan Lin of the Harvard Medical School, also co-founder of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood and author of Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. Dr. Lin, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
Well, when we come back, novelist Robin Cook puts concierge medicine on trial after a break here and now. Young, it's here and now. Best-selling author and physician Robin Cook has been known for taking on provocative, cutting-edge topics, organ donation, genetic engineering, fertility clinics, and, of course, coma. In his book Crisis, now out in paperback, it's concierge medicine, physicians available to patients 24/7 for an annual membership fee, which can range from $1,500 to $20,000 a year. These concierge companies get around insurance regulations by offering services that insurance companies don't usually cover, such as nutrition counseling. In the book Crisis, Craig Bauman is a Boston-based doctor with a midlife crisis and a concierge practice. After a patient dies, he's served with a malpractice lawsuit. On trial, Dr. Bauman, but also concierge medicine. We spoke with Robin Cook when Crisis first came out and asked why he chose to make concierge medicine the topic.
I kind of like to choose topics that people don't know too much about, and yet topics that I think are really going to affect medicine. And this is one of them, concierge medicine.
Well, tell us more about it. I mean, you know, we understand that it's doctors who set up these almost private practices and people pay these annual fees.
What it is that doctors have decided that they would charge people to be a member of a practice. And what the people were really paying for was that the doctor decided to limit his practice. And they'll say they'll give them nutrition counseling. They'll give them very elaborate yearly physicals, et cetera, et cetera. But what they're really giving them is access. And the way they can give that access is by limiting the practice. And ergo, from that comes the problem.
The problem being?
The problem being is it's already not that easy to find a good primary care physician, particularly in certain markets. And those markets where concierge medicine is having a big inroad, like Naples, Florida is one, it is now very much, much more difficult, in fact, almost impossible for somebody to find a good primary care physician without paying that kind of upfront fee.
Because this is taking doctors out of the pool of doctors who would treat patients.
That's right. So, in other words, you take somebody with a practice, let's say they have 3,000 people in their practice, and they say, all right, I've had enough, I'm fed up, whatever. I'm going to start a concierge practice. I'm going to limit it to 500 people. What happens to the other 2,500?
Well, this is the case of your fictional Dr. Craig Bauman, who says that he wants to go into concierge medicine because of the way he's been forced to practice by insurance companies. Tell us a little more about that, because you seem to agree that there's something completely out of whack with the healthcare system and the amount of time that doctors are allotted to see patients.
Well, it's particularly with primary care. I don't think a lot of people realize that primary care physicians are reimbursed a very small flat fee for a visit to a primary care physician. Now, that means if they get $50 plus to see someone, that doesn't make any difference whether the person has something as simple as a runny nose and it's a healthy person and whatnot. It's very quick. Or somebody comes in and has multitude of problems, has to have long explanation, has to be seen by specialists, long conversations with the family and with the patient, et cetera. And it's gotten to the point because of elevated costs in terms of practice location for employees that it's getting so that it's hard for these people to maintain a positive flow of money.
Well, it's also why you only get maybe 15 minutes with a doctor nowadays.
And
it's
if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Minutes. And it's why they have to make more referrals because they can't talk to you about problems that you may have. And so you end up getting, as you write, MRIs or CAT scans because the doctor doesn't have the time to look
to do it himself or herself. In other words, refers you on. Whereas perhaps it might be better if they talk to you and found out what your problem is, what is your complaint, and since they know you better, their doctor, et cetera, It just sort of makes a lot of sense.
But then you now have Dr. Craig Wellman, your fictional concierge doctor, who could now possibly be saying, be careful what you wish for, because he now has this private concierge practice, but now he has patients who demand to see him for hours at a time.
That's right.
And it's sort of the flip side of what you're talking about.
And one of the ironies in crisis is that the doctor gets sued for making a house call. That's one of the amenities that concierge doctors will provide. And one would think that, well, this is such a patient-oriented phenomena, they certainly wouldn't get sued for that. That's part of the irony of the story.
There are several others, which we won't get into because it sort of, you know, gives it, we don't want to give away the ending. One of them is, and you write about it in your author's notes, apparently you're represented, you say, by one of the characters, one of the fictional characters. It's a doctor that testifies, an expert witness, against concierge practices at this trial of your fictional doctor. But you also write that while he represents your thinking, if you were in practice today, you would want to be one.
Isn't that hypocritical?
Well, explain that.
Well, if I was in primary care today, there's no doubt I would want to practice in the circumstance of as a primary care physician, because if you have to see one patient every 5 or 10 minutes in order to make enough money to stay in business, you're not going to be able to be the kind of doctor that you're trained to be.
But on the other hand, you are one of those saying, and the ending of your book clearly points to your thinking, that concierge medicine is also a big problem.
It's a problem in terms of what it's doing to accessibility. It's also a problem because it flies in the face of one of the basic principles of medicine, and that is that you don't show any discrimination in terms of who you take care of. And in the situation with concierge medicine, you're really skewing it towards the people with money. So socioeconomic status then is determining who it is that the concierge medicine is seeing. And that flies in the face of professionalism.
Right. But by the way, you suggest how the system might be fixed and there might be no need for concierge medicine. And that is that you suggest that there be more of a sliding scale on how doctors are paid instead of $50 per 15-minute visit, that they be paid
by the hour.
By the hour, how long a visit has to go.
That's how we pay all our other professionals.
But the questions about that would be, well, first of all, doesn't that mean that the older you are and the sicker you are, the more you have to pay?
But most people aren't paying out of their pocket anyway. They have insurance. It's insurance companies that are paying. The real problem is that our healthcare system has been skewed in the direction of specialty care and procedures. This is at the same time not recognizing the input that is so important from primary care. We have this fragmented, discontinuous healthcare system, mostly with specialists, which is like a labyrinth for the normal individual to kind of find their way in. They need a primary care physician to, in a certain sense, guide them through this system. We should be paying our primary care physicians more than we should be paying our specialty physicians.
Just one last question, though. If you were to pay a doctor, you know, for a 10-minute visit, if that's all you needed, or a 40-minute visit, if that's what you needed, you know, it would be clocked that way. I just can't imagine the paperwork, you know, of trying to gauge each visit, of the millions of doctor's visits.
Well, it works in every other professional's office. We pay our lawyers that way. We pay our accountants that way. All our professionals, except our primary care physicians, and in a certain sense, they are the ones that we need more than any of the others, to tell you the honest truth.
Mm-hmm. Crisis, the new fiction novel from Robin Cook about the world of concierge medicine, also called luxury medicine. What are some of the others?
Yeah, retainer medicine, right. Boutique medicine. There's a lot of different names because it's so new. It's only been around for about 10 years.
Well, now listen, you could afford it. Would you never do it?
Well, I'm lucky. I mean, as a physician myself, I have access to all sorts of people, and I actually experience the kind of medicine that I wish that everyone in this country experienced.
Doctor and author Robin Cook, we spoke to him about concierge medicine, the focus of his book Crisis, which is now out in paperback. His upcoming book, Critical, centers on drug-resistant staph infections. That's due out in October. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.